so you can kill my body. But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with my friend, governing board member of INET and Detroit alumni like myself, Mr. John Paul, or Dr. John Paul. How are you doing, John?
Good. How are you doing, Rob? How was it nice to talk to you?
It's nice to talk with you, as always. We've made an episode before as we were right at the starting gates of this podcast, but I thought here is the close of 2020, one of these, how do I say, unfortunately, in some ways, a very memorable year, but hopefully we can learn from it and unmask some certain things that were, how I'd say, changes overdue, and strike a new path forward, maybe not immediately with the pandemic lockdown, but in the not too distant future. And we have a new administration coming in, and a whole lot of whole lot of burdens on the agenda of transformations that need to be made in relation to climate and community and education and everything else. But I'm curious, what are you seeing if you look at this year? What did you learn, and what does it inspire you to want to do to make things better in the future?
Well, Rob, as you said, it's been a very, very difficult year. I mean, just a number of body blows, one after another. With I remember in January, before we got to the end of January, there'd already been two or three major things that happened. It's like, wow, the year just got off to a bang. And then the pandemic. And of course, then in California, where I am, the fires, and then George Floyd, and then it just never ended. And I think for a lot of people, it's sort of, have we hit rock bottom? And people begin to think there is no such thing as rock bottom. So I think what happened in the country and what happened in the world really, really demonstrated how ill-prepared, how structurally and even culturally, we were not prepared to deal with the pandemic, even though we've had some signs that we're going to be facing a pandemic. I think one hope was that, people always say what it would take to bring us together would be some outside attack like Martians or a pandemic. Well, we got the latter. Maybe we'll get Martians next year. But in a sense, it was a missed opportunity because while it was something that affects all of us, and in a sense, you could say a common enemy, although even that I think is a little bit problematic as we are thinking about the pandemic. Instead, we used it to divide ourselves in America. You know, whether you wear a mask or not mask, whether you believe in shelter in place or not shelter in place, are you going to get a vaccine? And it broke largely along party lines and largely along racial lines, not 100%, but significantly. And it was actually pushed by Trump and the right-wing elite. It's not clear to me why, except I think, to some extent, they trade on divisiveness. They trade on polarization. And so if the virus had an opportunity to create a space where we could be united, not mechanically, we have to massage it, we have to curate it, we have to talk about it. But if we could imagine, instead of turning on each other, turning toward each other and fighting this common threat that all of us are facing, instead, again, we turned on each other. And it wasn't just natural, although it was building on a lot of racial and other kind of resentment in the country. It also was led by big money, by big politics, and by the White House. With Trump out of the White House, there's a chance that some of that could turn a corner. We have a vaccine now. But over 70 million people, 73 million in counting, voted for Trump. And there's a lot of stuff about we need to understand Trump voters. I think we have to understand each other. But understanding is not a one-way street. And there's some pretty pernicious things that we have to deal with as well in terms of the sort of mean-spiritedness that people either embraced or forgave Trump for. I mean, as this administration winds down, he's trying to kill as many people on death row as possible. He's trying to open up the Arctic, even though we're talking about icebergs the size of Delaware breaking and floating out. And he's sort of saying, you know, let's do as much destruction as we can. Let's open up all the, you know, national forests for mining, even though we don't have an energy shortage. Let's make it hard for people to be counted. So let's do the census so we don't count immigrants. I mean, people still stick with that. And in some ways, it's not sticking with issues. I think it's actually sticking with Trump and what he represents, which is an ideological and an ontological shift of America being only for essentially a certain kind of person, largely white and Christian.
I saw an article today by a gentleman named Dan Siegel, and it was all about what he thought played a role. He said white supremacy is the only plausible explanation for the 2020 election results. Just simply, back of the envelope, I sampled some of his data. Trump won 58% of the white vote, 55% of white women, and Biden won 71% of the non-white vote. Among college-educated white men, Trump won 51-48, and he won among white men without college degrees by 70-28. Trump's success was very strong among evangelicals or the born-again Christians. Mm-hmm. They make up about 28% of the electorate, and he won 76% of that vote. And then just as a broader array, 69% of voters say that racism is an important problem in America. And of those 69%, they supported Biden by 68-30. But the voters who believe that racism is not a problem, that's 31%, supported Trump by 84-14. And I'll start right at the end, John. The question I would ask is, when they say they believe racism is a minor problem and they support Trump 84-14, are they masking a racial attitude by saying it's not important? Or because if given all of the data, it appears that racism is something that Trump fanned the flames of and seemed to correlate with the results quite a lot.
Well, I think that's right, Rob. I think there's some complexities. So to begin with, in a sense, you could say the news about white supporting Trump is not really new news. I mean, he has a slight bump over other Republicans running for president. But as you know, Johnson was the last presidential candidate for the Democratic Party that took the majority of white votes. And in that sense, you could say, and it's even more stark because the South, which was solidly Democratic because of the hostility and antipathy toward the Republican Party and Lincoln and the Civil War, the South for the next 100 years was solidly Democratic and rapidly anti-Republican. And then after the Civil Rights Amendment and the heart of the Civil Rights Movement, the South flipped and became the heart of the Republican Party. So even though they had antipathy toward the Republican Party, their willingness to align themselves with the party that they hated in favor of keeping or clawing back any progress that blacks had made was palpable. And there was a book called The South Shall Rise Again. And in a sense, it's not just the South now, it's the whole country. So in that sense, we've been on this trajectory for a long time. We've never as a country really embraced the notion of being a multiracial, multiethnic, multireligious country in practice. We've tried to do it in words, and there have been some exceptions. But as a country, whenever we try to actually expand the we to include all people, there's a white lash that keeps coming back over and over again. And then the centrist position becomes we have to accommodate white anxiety, which I'm not opposed to in some theoretical fashion, but the accommodated can't mean on the backs of Blacks and Latinos and people who are considered outside. So in some sense, Trump is sort of a deeper expression of that, and even a more explicit expression, because he ran on a more explicit racial terms. But it's also part of a larger American legacy. The other thing I would say is that I think race is really important. Racism is something slightly different, and I think we conflate the two. And also think when we talk about race, largely in this country, people think about people of color or Black people. And so even though I say in that 31% who don't think race is important, I think what many of them are saying is that discrimination against Blacks, or given the largest movement in our history, Black Lives Matter is not legitimate. But many of those same people, if you said, is there a reason for white resentment? They would say yes. So in that sense, there's a growing salience and importance of white identity. But people are not yet calling it race, right? And in fact, some politicians, some of whom I like and some of whom I don't, but they have this constant refrain that we have to avoid identity politics and instead focus on large universal issues like the working class. When they say the working class, they actually mean the white working class. They're actually stepping back to an identity politics, but it's in favor of a certain group as opposed to another group. So I do think race, identity is extremely important. And in that, racism and even white supremacy and in anti-Black racism. But I also think it's mixed up with some other things. I don't think there's a single thing. I think the economy and race and racism and immigration and all these things are interrelated. But there are some stories that we'd like to avoid. We're much more comfortable talking about class than we are talking about race in the country.
I'm not real familiar, and I'm curious. What role does education play in healing us from these racial divides, or has the potential to be a healing force?
Well, certainly education is important. I mean, there are different ways of thinking about what's the injury and what's the heal, and how do we heal. And part of the thing is that a lot of the ways we think about healing is basically settling the score. And some people would say the score has already been settled. And what's the score? The score is a country that's founded upon the taking of land from Native Americans and the bodies of Black people and the mistreatment of Asians for much of its history. That's the American history. That's our history. It's not Black history. It's not Native American history. It's not Chinese history. This is our history. This is what our country was founded on. And by most accounts, Americans consider the greatest president in U.S. history to be Lincoln. Lincoln was very keenly aware of that. He was also aware that, and he gave some really wonderful speeches that would make people think he's Bernie Sanders. He's talking about the danger of corporations, the danger of concentration of wealth and money. He talked about he feared that more than he feared the Southern Army. So they're a combination of those things, but they're interrelated. And so education, which, you know, really only started after the Civil War, education in the country, properly done, could play a substantial role. But it has to be more than educating for jobs. Sometimes we think of education really as trade schools, whereas Jefferson, despite all his foibles, and Dewey thought about education as making people into citizens. And a citizen from their perspective meant you had the ability to take someone else's perspective. You have the ability to empathize. And it's not something that you're born into. You actually have to actually be curated, you have to be educated about. We're not educating that way today. We think of education as technical skills so you can get a job in the new economy, not unimportant, But the most important threat to the United States and the world is not the lack of technology. It's not that we don't have the right app or the right iPhone. It's that we actually turn toward or against each other, all the resources that we have. So education matters, but so does geography. The fact that the country is segmented largely in terms of Trump supporters are very isolated from Biden or Bernie supporters physically. So we sorted ourselves out. Some people talk about rural versus urban, again, overstated. But it is true that we don't physically have contact with each other. And so it makes it easier. We're not physically, don't have physical contact. We don't have good education. Our media is not doing the job it was designed to do. And so it creates this possibility for us to live in alternate realities. And those alternate realities are really hostile toward each other. And we have to figure out a way of bridging that on multiple levels.
And how do you see in 2020, not only did we see what you might call the glaring deficiencies in the healthcare system in the United States, but the disproportionate burden that people of color experience. In other words, the healthcare system does better for affluent people and for white people than it does for people of color, according to the COVID statistics.
That's exactly right. And, you know, in a way, we sometimes are attracted to the notion of being raised or colorblind. It's not possible because of the work around, I mean, the way structures work and the way the mind works. It's not possible. It's not even desirable. And we sort of misquote King in that for that proposition. But where we are really blind is structurally blind. We don't see the work that structures are doing. And while we talk about race or identity not being essential, that is, there's no biological basis for understanding race. So what's the basis? The basis is sociological, political, and cultural. And so it really says that people are situated in a certain way that actually that racializes them, that the way we sort people actually racialize the people. Now, what that means is that when something happens, like the virus, it's moving through that structure. Anything we move through that structure, it's going to be amplified by the structure. So early on at the Othering and Belonging Institute, which I direct, we noticed that people were saying, including Governor Cuomo, that the virus was the great equalizer. And I'm saying, no. That's a nice proposition, but it's highly wrong because it's going to move through a system. And the system is not going to all of a sudden change. And so it's going to amplify all of the inequities, all of the structural problems that are there. People who don't have money for housing. And for Black people and other people of color, Native Americans, Latinos now in California, in the farm working communities, it's just being devastated. Well, you look at their structure. Most of them live in tenement houses or in group houses, can't easily distance 6 feet apart. In terms of washing your hands, you have to walk as far as a mile to wash your hands for a shared bathroom. You know, it's like everything is out of place. The hospitals are not there. So everything, all the tools that we think of in terms of either stopping the spread or fighting the virus are not as available structurally across the country for marginalized communities. What does it mean to be marginal? It means you don't have access to things that people who are not marginal have. Who are the people who are not marginal? They're generally well-educated, more disproportionately white, more disproportionately urban than other people. So we shouldn't be surprised that really it's like shining a flashlight through a filter. And then you see all of the things on the filter in the shadow, in the projection. Yes, they're there. They're not in the flashlight. They're in the filter. And so these structures, but I will say, even as they debate as to how to distribute the vaccine, and I'm not saying there's a simple way, but I'm heartened a little bit that they're now talking about equity. They're saying, how do we be fair, right? And in a sense, they're starting to recognize the that people are not situated the same. And it's not because of the pigment in their skin. It's not because of the genes. It's because of the way structures and race interact in the United States and the world. And so you have to pay attention to those structures. And it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a racist Bull Connor behind the distribution of those inequalities. Once they're in place, if we're an automatic pilot, they reproduce. If we're going to address them, we have to be deliberate, because that's what structures do. Structures are forms of habituated practices that we no longer have to think about. They're on automatic control.
I guess if you were to in this is, how do I say, potentially quite feasible, but let's just call it a fantasy for tonight. If you were appointed a czar inside of the incoming Biden administration, what steps would you lay out to try to heal this country related to health, climate, infrastructure, education, anything that comes to your mind?
Well, what I would propose, and maybe we can propose this without being czars, what I propose is, how do we actually move forward where we all have a bright shared future? How do we expand the we? In order to do that, first of all, we have to really listen to people, because a lot of times, again, people's differences, even political differences, are really reflecting other structural differences. And so, you know, that I've seen that cartoon about four people carrying someone on their shoulder, and it's saying, for the people doing the carrying, half a mile is a long walk. For the person riding, it's a piece of cake. So some of us are riding, or more or less riding, and some of us are carrying. And so our differences are not simply personal, they're structural, and then they're massaged by our leaders. So one of the things I would do would be really clear, not just in words, but also in practice, of saying, we're not gonna leave anyone behind. This is a future for all of us. And this is gonna be reflected in our program. And Rob, you know, that's my sweet spot when I talk about creating a world where we all belong through the practice of targeted universalism, which requires us to look at how people are situated differently. And then say, it allows us to talk about race without talking about genes. It allows us to talk about a society where we all go forward. And I will say, it's not symmetrical. I think Trump and many of his supporters are deliberately trying to tear the country down. They're deliberately trying to start a secession. They're deliberately saying they don't want to be related to people they consider the other. The people who are not in support of that vision, people who associate themselves with progressives or social justice advocates, I think, and I associate myself with that as well, I think we have to be very clear that we're not trying to just build a world for ourselves. We're not trying to build a world for just people of color. We're not trying to build a world just for people who are progressive. We're trying to co-create a world where everyone belongs, including those who don't agree with us. And that means not just a different story, but a different set of practices. So, for example, there's a big fight, and I think in the Biden administration, about who would be the Secretary of Agriculture. Would it be people in the city? Would it be an urbanite, a person who's conscious of lack of food in the city, food deserts, homeless lines? Or will it be a person in from the rural area who will be aware of terrorists, be aware of farmers actually not making money, be aware of land being going fallow? Well, it needs to be both. Regarding, the person may be one person, but you could say, first of all, it's a bureau with thousands of people. But you could say, you can make it clear, both in words and in practice, that we're going to take care of both of these issues, and they're not the same. And so we're going to need different strategies, and we're going to listen to people from those different strategies, and we're going to bring them together. And their charge is going to be, yes, how do you take care of your community, your immediate community, but then how do you also take care of the larger community? Your charge as part of this collective we is not just to take care of your group or to define your group narrowly, But while you focus on your group, make sure they're not left out. How do you also include others who you don't always see in your group? So it seems to me that's the orientation. And that orientation should show up over and over and over again, whether you're talking about education, whether you're talking about school, whether you're talking about healthcare, whether you're talking about, and instead what we do is we have people compete for what's perceived as narrow, inadequate resources, scarce resources. And that creates more anxiety and more fighting and more polarization. So you're saying to that, in that situation, the future's not for all of us. There's going to be winners and losers. And then people fight to be winners and not to be losers.
You know, as I listen to you, I'm reminded, I used to teach a course with Serene Jones at the Union Theological Seminary. And we called it economics and theology, or means and ends. But one of the key pillars that the students, these were graduate students, kind of at the time of Occupy Wall Street, looking for a direction forward. And one of the key pillars that they really reacted positively to was an exercise that A. Philip Randolph and Martin Luther King conducted called a freedom budget for all Americans. And I remember reading about it, learning about it in conjunction with the students, because it was, as you said, we're not going out to, Dr. King was very explicit, I'm not going out to do something for the black community. I'm going out to do something for human beings that we all should experience.
Right.
And obviously this was intertwined with his concern about excessive militarism, mm-hmm. racism, and materialism, particularly in the context of the Vietnam War. It wasn't much beyond that time before, Dr. King gave his famous Time to Break the Silence Beyond Vietnam speech.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was quite brilliant that they weren't creating what you might call a special fix for a subset of society. They were saying we should all have access to what I'll call the baseline platform for a meaningful life.
Right.
And it was just very, I don't know, it was very inspiring and very wholesome. And it resonated in my mind as I was listening to you, that you're kind of coming from that same perspective.
I'm definitely influenced by Reverend Dr. King. And the ideas are sort of, you could say, an update of his ideas, an update of Einstein's ideas, an update of Aristotle's ideas. People who've looked at how do you actually construct a healthy society have frequently talked about this, using slightly different words, but very similar concepts of one, how do you get everyone to a place where they can fully participate and fully enjoy what society has to offer? But two, also recognizing that people are not situated the same. So what the mistake that we made in this country, we made a couple of big ones. One was just assumption that equality means you treat everybody the same. Our concept of equality in the West comes largely from Aristotle, probably influenced also by Native people. But Aristotle talked about fairness requires you to treat people who are situated the same. That's equality. But fairness also requires you to treat people who are situated differently, differently. That's what he called that geometric equality. We got the first part of it. Let's treat everybody the same. But we missed the second part of it. And Aristotle was giving us 2,000 years ago was saying no. He was actually describing what I call targeted universalism. And so when you say we're going to do something special for people who are living in Detroit and dying at 3 times the rate of other people, it's not because they're black. It's because they're situated differently because of the way the structures work. When you say that we're going to do something different in terms of getting water out to reservations and in the farm communities, we're not doing that because people are Latinos or because people are Native people. We're doing it because they're situated differently. And so it's not just a practice. It's also a way of understanding and communicating. And this is one of the rubs. We're also saying we're not indifferent to how whites are situated. Because in our society, and sometimes when we talk about race, we assume that whites already have everything they need. Clearly they don't. We oftentimes engage in what's sometimes referred to oppositional politics. We have to be against you in order to be for me. And while I'm not totally against oppositional politics, I just read an article about post-oppositional. How do we actually go beyond that and say to people, everyone has a place, or potentially has a place. Now, it might mean a different tax structure of corporations. It might even mean a different governance structure of corporations, but it's not anti-corporate. It's saying, how do we create a world and a society that serve people in society? And we'll use all the instruments and ingenuity that we can in terms of technology, in terms of mass media, in terms of corporations, but it have to serve the people and have to serve all the people.
Yeah. So right now, if you were to, how would I say, want to shake people out of a cynicism, there's a certain cynicism that many people have towards the Democratic Party, the elite meritocracy kind of criticisms are put forward frequently. But if you were in the Biden administration, in the first 100 days, what do you do so that we all feel that we're on a different path relative to where we've been traveling the last 4 years? And I'm saying that not to just be on a different path. I'm saying it is the equivalent of a stun gun of changing your perceptions so that you do not want to go back to that other path. It's a healing change in trajectory.
Well, what I would say for the Biden administration and for all of us, really, for certainly for funders, that we should be both lifting up and amplifying and creating capacities for people to tell their stories and to bridge. So how do we begin to, in a curated way, it's already happening, right? How do we begin to actually notice it, lift it up, and fund it, support it? So in New York, as you know, is going through a major thing of trying to rethink its schools. But I was a little disturbed with the language because they talked about redistributing the resources of the schools. That creates, again, this idea of scarcity, and we're fighting over it. So we have to take something from one group to give to another group. But that usually doesn't work. You're creating tension, because even the group that's relatively well off oftentimes feel like they're just barely treading water with that. So I would create those possibilities. I would invite people in, and they may not come. You know, I have, because it's also, people are benefiting from this. Some people are benefiting from this certain system, especially some of the elites. So when you say to them, you know what, we're going to start shifting from oil, but we're going to do it so that there's a soft landing. We want you to participate in that. And we'll whether this oil or coal, we'll help subsidize that soft landing, but we got to get there. Now, they may say no. They may say yes. That's up to them. But at least we made the offer. And so can we create spaces? Because it's funny, right? I mean, the planet doesn't belong to the oil barons. It doesn't belong to the social justice folks. It doesn't belong to the white supremacists. It's our planet, all of our planets. It belongs to us, and we belong to it. And how do you actually begin to do that? So I would actually look for people, from different walks of life, from different voices, different institutions, and creating space where they can really come together, be charged with, one, exemplifying this conversation, and just to really talk to each other. In some cases, that will produce really profound different solutions. Some cases, it will not. But even if we begin to talk to each other in a serious way, not just to win, that would be very different. The last thing is that the world's not done with us yet. Whether the vaccine is effective or not, and I certainly hope it is, and I hope people take it, I hope it's safe, we're not going back to before all this. The world is changing. The world is already changing. We were already sort of getting behind, if you will. And so we really need to think about how do we collectively shape our collective future? And here's the thing I would say, Rob. There's some deal breakers. One deal breaker, non-negotiable in my mind, is that all human life counts. All human life counts. I also believe we're all profoundly interconnected. Not always fairly, but we're also interconnected. That we share this planet, that it belongs to all of us. And that both the resources and the pain needs to be fairly distributed. And that's the conversation we're going to have. And I would have some early examples of that. I would put some resources behind it in different communities. And so I might deliberately say something, right? So when I talked about rural and urban, being a concrete example, there's a huge opioid problem through the whole country, but it's still situated in rural America. But there's also other drug issues in urban areas. Why not link them? Don't pick a winner and loser. You say too many Americans are killing themselves with drugs and suicide. And if we don't care if they're in rural Georgia or in the most urban area in the country, we care about them. And we recognize, again, that they're situated differently, but there's some commonality. They're both dealing with pain. They're both dealing with drugs. And we may even bring them together so they can actually see each other. They're not caricatures of each other. When you other someone, you flatten them. They become one thing. You don't see their multiplicity. So I create space and fund some of that work and then lift it up, and we'll make mistakes, but I think that's the only way forward together.
Do you see a way of what you might call quickly healing the polarization? The story I often hear is that Trump did something very interesting, which was he called out both parties. People forget he beat 15 Republicans before he beat Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. And the mantra, if you will, was the system is rigged. And everybody kind of rose up to that. I remember going back to Detroit, where you and I come from, and people were telling me that he came right after the Republican convention and he gave a speech to the Detroit Economic Club like 2 days after he got the nomination and scolded the management for having lost so many jobs in Detroit at the big three auto companies. And even people I know who worked there as executives said, boy, this is a different cut of fish, this guy. But after he'd been in power and had done the tax reform and the deregulation of the fossil fuel industry and so forth, it sort of looked like what they call a seduce and abandon. He didn't engage or go into a policy realm, which we might say was part of the healing. And to keep his coalition together, he appeared to resort to an inflamed identity politics. And that was well underway even before the pandemic. I think it became more desperate even in the context of his feeling like his ship was sinking. But what kind of things, you know, you've talked about, we're all in this together kind of notion, putting resources behind it. But are there words to which you might call dissolve the divide? Are there things that people should read, or are there things that people should practice to help us move irreversibly away from that, how would I say, inciting of polarity that we've just been through?
Well, the answer is, I think there's some, certainly we could, as you know, Rob, we live in stories. We don't just interact with the world. We interact through the vision that we have of the world. And the stories, the dominant stories, and there's more than one that we trade on right now, it's not working. And so Trump traded on one story of a small, basically white national we. And even in this campaign, he was attacking Mexicans, immigrants. He had this weird affinity for Russia, but this real obsession over China. And, you know, Rob, you and I have been to China together, and I'm not a big fan of their system. But to me, to be candid, it's smacked of irrational, over the top, and racism. And I think Americans were too quick to buy into it. He didn't just attack China. He attacked Europe. He attacked Germany. He attacked England. He was, you know, flailing about anyone who was in his way. And yes, he did say some things about, you know, we should protect you, but so did Bernie. But Trump's was laced with racism, because besides saying we should protect you, he then very quickly said, and those people, whether it be blacks or Mexicans or immigrants from the Caribbean, from the shithole countries, those are the bad people we need to protect from. So it wasn't just an economic populism. He, from the very beginning, even when he's on the campaign trail, was laced with sexism and racism that his groups were much too willing to overlook. And some of the people who came out and supported him, like the KKK, they weren't supporting him just because of his economic policies. They were supporting him because of his racism. And our, you know, frankly, conservative white brothers and sisters were too willing, if not because of, in spite of, they're too willing to overlook that. They're too willing to say, okay. Now remember, white resentment toward blacks doing okay or better, and blacks aren't doing great, has been around way before Trump. What Trump said is that you should be resentful. You should be pissed at those people. So he may have identified the problem, but the solution was polarization and hate. And it's hard to separate those things for Trump. Now, Bernie had a very similar message, and it wasn't so much polarization and hate. Bernie didn't do quite as well. So I do think you have to talk to those issues. But you have to actually talk to people in such a way. And in terms of healing, I would say two things. One, right now, a lot of Trump supporters believe the election's been stolen. They're in the midst of doubling down for a fight. Some of them are talking about succeeding. So you can't heal with people. You can't force people to participate in healing. People have to come to that on their own accord. You can create space. You can create an olive branch. You can create a bridge. But you can't force people to do it. We need healing not just among Trump supporters. We need healing within the Democratic Party. There's a fight between the left and the center. There's a fight between the left and the left. There's a fight between the center and the center. We're breaking and polarizing all over. And so I would actually start with people who really do. And there's some data that suggests that maybe 70%+ of Americans want to see some healing. Those aren't necessarily the political elites. They're not necessarily the people who are organized. And even, again, I said this earlier, it's not symmetrical, but a lot of us who are political activists, we also eschew really healing. We have a sort of narrow view of power, and we just think of winning and losing. And that's not good enough. We can't win if half of America is left out. And also we have to actually really be critical of dominance, of supremacy. Not just white supremacy, not just white dominance, but all kinds of dominance. We have to challenge that. We have to actually tell a story where we actually are in cooperation. And there'll be some competition, but how do we learn to really cooperate with each other? Not just in the United States, but around the world. And right now we don't have that. And so maybe if we offered that to Europe, maybe if we offered that to China, maybe they would take it, maybe not. But right now we're not offering it. Instead, what we're selling is that we, the United States, has to be the most dominant country in the world, and other parts of the world, whether it's Europe or China, is threatening that. That we, basically, white Christian Americans, have the dominant culture in the world, and all other cultures are threatening that. So we have to really challenge dominance. When we challenge that, we're not trying to supplant and say, we're going to take your dominance and replace it by ours. So that, no, we're actually talking about something completely different. And we want you to participate in what that is. So it is a different story. And there'll be some people who will get it and move on it quickly, who want to. And there'll be some who will oppose it. And we'll learn as we go forward.
Well, John, one of the casualties of this year, 2020, was that you and I didn't get to travel to France with people like Cornel West and Ed Pavlik and others to hold a conference at the home of James Baldwin in honor of his thinking. And I'm curious, obviously we couldn't travel. We talked about doing something remote, which I think we might be able to do in the coming months. But I'm curious what you think, how would I say, the insight of the person, James Baldwin, illuminates for the challenges that we face now.
Well, you know, from my perspective, James Baldwin is not only a profound teacher, and, you know, he's also someone who's from the future, because he describes a future that we all need to aspire to. In my book, I use him a lot in terms of his quotes. There's a new article I'll send you, and maybe you can share with your readers, called Baldwin and Buddhism, Denial of Death, White Supremacy, and the Promise of Racial Justice. So he was right there. Some of us are just now starting to think about Buddhism and race, and Baldwin was thinking about that decades ago. It's also interesting because in some fashion, one would say Baldwin has as much reasons to be wounded, as to be cynical, as to be turned off as anyone. And I'm not saying he's not perfect, but he rejected those feelings. He was not only at times mistreated by the white community, he was also sometimes mistreated by the straight community, sometimes mistreated by the literary community. And yet he remained the beacon of hope. He left the country for a little while, brokenhearted, but he came back to help not just himself, but others. So I think the way he lived his life and his writing is just profound. When we talk about someone who has a bead on the future, we call him a prophet. James Baldwin is a poetic, literary, philosophical, spiritual prophet. And we would do well to spend some time looking at the future through James Baldwin's eyes.
Yeah, I think when you said Baldwin and Buddhism, I think there are two books that I read this year that had more impact on me than any other. The first was by a Buddhist woman named Pema Chodron called When Things Fall Apart. And it was about one's frame of mind and how to be constructive amidst the fear and the anxiety that engulfs you. And the second, much later in the year, was from a man that Martin Luther King nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. His name is Thich Nhat Hanh. He's a Vietnamese Buddhist. And the name of that book was Fear. And when I came out of that book, there was one thing that resonated with me more than anything else. And I reached out to some of my friends who are practitioners of meditation and spiritual discipline. And that was what they called Sangha, S-A-N-G-H-A. And unlike my preconception of meditation, where you go sit by yourself quietly and go inward, what Thich Nhat Hanh said was that ultimately, after you've developed these practices of mindfulness and what he calls loving kindness, a sangha is a group, and you do walking meditations together. You do quiet or seated in a room, but together, and share with each other, because that, in his mind, was the way you inoculate yourself from fear, by feeling the connection and belonging to community. When I heard you referring to Baldwin in relation to Buddhism, I find myself very curious.
Yes. Well, I sent you the article, and I think you'll appreciate it. And, we live in a world where fear is rampant, but so is hope. So we've talked a lot about the split and about the challenges facing us. We're also at a time in the country where many more Americans are talking about anti-Black racism, where white Americans from all walks of life, from generals in the army to Fortune 500 companies to Black activists, queer and straight, are on this, taken to the streets calling for something bigger. That's actually, so we should not just sort of focus on this underbelly. There's a light there. There's a crack in this armor. And our job is to turn that crack into a hole and then take it down altogether. So I think that, and part of it will be walking in two directions at once. So even though there's things to be concerned about, if not afraid of, there's also things to be hopeful of. And how do we make sure that without having our heads in the sand, we don't become crippled with fear? And part of it is the stories we live. And part of it is a meditative practice. In my mind, one of the things that one benefit of meditation is that it allows you to have a bigger plate. So you can have more stuff on your plate. Some people think it's wiping your plate clean. In my perspective, it's not wiping it clean, it's getting a bigger plate. And so you can hold fear, you can hold hope, you can hold pain, you can hold joy. You can hold the multiple aspects of yourself in the world with a certain kind of grace and possibly even love. And I think that's what's called upon us, to be multiple. And to even as we work, to have joy and ease in some of these challenges.
So do you, we have a bunch of, a very large number of young scholars now with INET's Young Scholars Initiative. And I'm curious as to, with, I think their numbers are approaching or a little over 16,000.
No.
If you could prescribe three things for them to read to help them through 2021, what would they be?
You know, I'm not sure, but here's some things that might be on my list. And I think I would put on the list some of the work by Harari, such as Sapien. I think I would include some work by Thich Nhat Hanh. He has one book about love. Depending on who they are, I mean, also I love Isabel Wilkins' new book, although I'm not sure I completely agree with it, but Cast. I'm trying to think and grasp of something that's a little more future-oriented, because while I think it's important we get to the future by stepping through the present, but I think oftentimes we step on the present and end up falling into the past. And so I don't want to, you know, I'm not one of people, the past is present, but we have to get to the future. We have to be able to imagine something different and better. And I'm trying to think of a book I've read recently, nothing comes to mind, that invites that kind of future. I look what I'll send it to you. Maybe you could suggest to me what that book is.
For me, I don't know. I'm always tempted, because of the way his music affects me, to suggest people read a book called Coltrane on Coltrane. That John Coltrane's, it's very interesting. I did a webinar this past year with a physicist who wrote a book called The Jazz of Physics. And he was from Trinidad. He had, because Professor Alexander from Brown University. And he wrote in his book about how much John Coltrane understood about the theory of relativity and quantum mechanics. And he, who was a child prodigy who came to New York, and went on to be a professor of physics at Brown University and quite highly regarded, prestigious postdoc before that. He took up playing the saxophone and learned music, how would I say, in the aftermath of becoming a masterful physicist. But it was amazing to me to hear about his sense, which you might call versatility and interactiveness between heart and mind.
Yes.
And there is a book that I just embarked on reading by a woman named Sarah Blondin, who's from, I believe she's from British, well, she lives in British Columbia with her husband and children. And it's called Heart-Minded. And it's about how the mind, we're talking about a time of acute fear, how the mind sometimes in a like a scientific inquiry can be exploring, can be uncovering and illuminating. But sometimes the mind performs as an anesthetic to insulate you from painful thought or to anesthetize your fears. And what Sarah talks about, and there's something like 19 meditations associated with the book, is how to break out of thinking that mind, like the scientist, is the right way, and to, which you might call, get back into the poetic spirit, which is somewhat less armored, somewhat less defensive, to help you evolve. Yeah. And in the context of reading that book, this I read another book recently called Radical Acceptance by a woman named Tara Brach, who's a Buddhist and a trained in psychotherapy. And Tara Brach's book was essentially about in acutely uncomfortable circumstances, learning how to accept what is, even if you don't want to accept it, meaning allowing it to persist in your life, but recognizing what it is that causes you discomfort allows you to start to move beyond that discomfort by what she calls the combination of compassion and attention. Attention to understand where you are, and compassion with yourself, with other people, some people who provoke you, so that you can maintain a sense of balance and move beyond. And I guess, John, you know, being a social scientist, economist, that those sound like funny recommendations from me, but I see so many people traumatized this year, that people like Thich Nhat Hanh, like Pema Chodron, like Sarah Blondin, I think, and like this Tara Brach, I think they're getting into a process which helps us be constructive members of the community and in some ways not burn ourselves out in the process of striving amidst all this anxiety.
Well, I'm going to give you three more books, and by the time these young scholars read all these books, they won't be young anymore. But anyway, one of them is called The Force of Nonviolence by Judith Butler.
Okay.
A second one is called Down to Earth. Let me see if I can pull up the author. It's Lafleur. He's a French writer, quite beautiful. Let me see if I can think of the third one now. Oh, I know. A Buddhist History of the West by
Loy.
Yeah.
I used to teach that at the Union Theological Seminary because the last chapter was called The Religion of Markets.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a great book. And I've seen him lecture at Union Theological Seminary as well.
Yeah,
that's a great suggestion.
Friend, and he's not just a he's a scholar and a practitioner. So he's not just things that he doesn't live. He's not just living things. He actually thinks about them. So he's a, and he spent about 20 years as a Buddhist scholar in Japan.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I'm going to have to create a list and associated with this conversation. We'll create a list of links and so forth so people can go to the website, or we can create a little memo for the Young Scholars Initiative, and they can track down these different sources of emotional and intellectual nourishment that we're presenting.
Well, they're lucky to be part of this program. We're lucky to have them.
That's right. Well, they're the future.
Right.
You know, how would I say, Teddy Pendergrass, about a teacher's got to teach a new way.
Mm-hmm.
Because the children, the young people are where the future is. And you got to teach them the very best you can.
Yeah.
That's from his song, Wake Up Everybody. So I think, Josh, say from my own perspective, knowing you for a handful of years and working with you, you've taught me a lot. And I'm very grateful to know you and to work with you and to share your perspective with the audience from this podcast.
Well, that's mutual. And I only have learned a lot from you, just in the heart place. It's just, as I say, a brother from another mother. So I appreciate and love you and your family and the work you're doing, but also the person you are. So thank you.
Yeah, we're developing some momentum here.
All right.
Yeah, you got your final thoughts, but we can come back together and keep building on this reading list
I'd like to see your list, but yes, let's keep it going.
Good. We'll keep it on. Anyway, any last thoughts before we sign off?
There's a saying which I like, two sayings I'll give you. One is, the future belongs to those who participate in this creation. And the second is this saying, which is, dialogue is necessary and possible because we are the same and different. If we were just different, it wouldn't be possible. If we were just the same, it wouldn't be necessary.
Well, I'll finish with a joke. There was a famous oracle who played baseball named Yogi Berra. And his son, Dale, was a baseball manager. And one day at a press conference, he was ascending up the steps after a press conference, somebody said, "Well, Dale, aren't you going to say something, like your father?" And he looked out at the audience and he said, "The similarities between me and my father are different." which led you to believe instantly that he was Yogi Berra's son.
Was his son.
Anyway, John, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We'll talk again in the coming year as we see things unfold, and I look forward to working with you.
Same here.
Happy holidays, and best to you and your family.
Same here. Have a nice transition.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.